Public safety power outages continue across California. The peak of those gusty north winds is forecast for midday today. On Insight, the latest from the California Office of Emergency Services. Then our CAP Radio News team will answer questions that we've had from you about the power outages. Ben Adler joins me today for Capital Chat with the balancing act that Governor Newsom is managing between the statewide power decisions and his deadline to sign or veto hundreds of pieces of legislation. And later in the hour, an in-depth visit to the Sacramento neighborhood that became a flashpoint for change, a place known recently for confrontation and controversy, but an area that's also been a beloved home to generations of families and some famous names, too. It's a new podcast titled Making Meadowview. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's coming up today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak, and we are live in the studio. North winds blew overnight, as they were forecast to do. The wildfire danger continues to be high, and the public safety power outages, as they are called, continue today. Power is being restored to some PG&E customers who were without it since yesterday or even the night before. The same is the case with Southern California Edison customers. Let's start the hour with the latest from the California Office of Emergency Services. Brian May, Public Information Officer for Cal OES, is on the phone. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Beth. How are you?
Are we in an emergency situation now on Thursday morning?
I wouldn't necessarily describe it as an emergency situation. What I would describe it is just very high risk, and we at the state level are looking at situations up and down the state. We obviously focus a lot on Northern California, but we've got these Santa Ana winds picking up in Southern California later today. They'll be doing some shutoffs, power shutoffs down in Southern Cal later today. So we're just looking at everything across the state, trying to identify vulnerabilities and issues that may come up.
What part of the state, then, is most at risk today?
Well, for the morning hours, it's still Northern California. In the Bay Area, we saw winds of 70, 75 miles an hour. Those will start to shift down south. I heard you mention some numbers earlier. PG&E is already starting to return power to some customers. I think the latest number that I saw from PG&E was about 615,000 customers, and that's after some restoration took place in Humboldt County.
I realize that you had a 7 a.m. briefing. What details from that can you share with us?
From a state level, the good news was the briefing was it was relatively quiet. Again, these power outages are happening because we have incredibly dangerous fire conditions, the worst fire conditions we've seen over the last 2 years, and we know how bad the weather has been over the last 2 years. So the good news with the briefing was it was relatively quiet. There were some small fires that started up. I think the most dangerous one was in Moraga. It was very close to some buildings, but they jumped on that very quickly. The fact that we don't have a large wildfire burning right now is incredibly good news because we have resources available. We've pre-positioned about 25 teams across the state. They're not battling a large fire right now. They're ready to go should something pop up.
Many people think that the decision to have power or not have power solely sits within the utility companies. Could you explain the chain of process or decision making that has to happen for power in any area to be restored?
Well, I know we work in collaboration with PG&E. They're embedded within here at OES. We also work, obviously, very close with the National Weather Service here as well and CAL FIRE. So for the restoration process, I know PG&E has to inspect these lines. The numbers that I've seen, they've got about 6,300 people on the ground that are ready to start inspecting. That inspection can't begin until the wind event is over. They obviously can't go out while it's still happening. But as soon as the winds die down, they're going to send their crews out. They also have 45 helicopters that they have to inspect these lines. We're talking about a massive amount. I mean, we're talking about the amount of lines that have been de-energized could circle around the earth right now. So there's a lot to inspect, but as soon as the winds die down, they'll start that process.
Key to all this, then, is the weather, obviously, but then the National Weather Service, right?
Every briefing, Beth, that we do begins with the National Weather Service, and it doesn't really matter what type of event we're talking about, whether it's a wildfire, a flood, tsunamis on the coast. Every briefing that we have begins with the National Weather Service because weather is so key to what we do, which reminds us all just to stay vigilant. We may start seeing power being turned on again, but we still have incredibly high wildfire dangers outside right now. We all need to take care and make sure that we're not going to cause anything.
I feel like I've hit the high points that we've been thinking about and we've been asked about, Brian. Is there anything else in this scenario that has been really top of the priority list from your perspective that out of Cal OES we should know and be aware of?
You know, I think we take this opportunity to remind us all as Californians, we live in a beautiful state, but California is the most disaster-prone state in the nation, and it's a good reminder for all of us. Stay on top of plans. Make sure that you discuss with your family where you would go if you have to leave somewhere. And now's a good reminder, keep the gas tanks full. If you're an energy car, if you're a power car, a battery-powered car, make sure that battery stays charged. I don't walk around with a lot of cash these days. You may not be able to use your debit card if your power is shut off, so have some cash on hand and enough food and water for your family to get through for about 72 hours. Just let's all be ultra aware right now until we can get out of these fire conditions.
All right, Brian, thanks so much for making time for us today.
You're welcome, Beth.
That is Brian May, PIO for Cal OES, and you can follow the changing situation at capradio.org. By the way, you can also continue to reach out to us with questions. In the studio with me now are ATC anchor Randall White and digital producer Emily Zentner. Hi to both of you.
Beth, good to see you.
I think people couldn't imagine how much you've been fielding through your computers the last couple days. You've been part of Cap Radio's effort to manage the questions and research the answers for listeners. So what's being asked most often, Emily?
The question we've gotten most is, this is my address. Am I going to be impacted by these outages? And unfortunately, PG&E's website has been kind of up and down over the past 2 days. So that's not been a super reliable place for people to get information.
I'd say more down than up.
Yeah,
and
more
down. Supposedly launched a new one last night.
They did. So that's been up for a little bit. I haven't gotten a chance to explore it that much. But if there continues to be PG&E website problems, we do actually have a map of the impacted areas on our website. So you can head to capradio.org. There's a little magnifying glass button where you can search your address and see if you're going to be impacted by the outage.
Anecdotally, in the newsroom, we've had people that have had problems with the new website. I just tried it before we came on the show and was able to use it efficiently. Yeah. But I really think this website issue is going to be a problem moving forward, that PG&E could not foresee the number of people that were going to access their website. They told me yesterday, Brandy Merlot, the spokeswoman for PG&E, told me that they did bolster what do they need, Emily, for that to
server
work?
Power.
The server
yes.
power. Yeah, they bolstered the server power, but not by nearly enough to handle the traffic that they saw.
You just led nicely into the next question, which is that we're hearing 500,000 customers or 700,000 customers, up to 2 million customers. But how many people does that represent? And how many individuals actually are impacted, Emily?
So that word customer, according to PG&E, actually represents about 3 people. So if you take that into account, and we have about 700,000 customers so-called impacted, it's going to be about 200 million or about 2 million people, excuse me, who could be impacted by these power outages.
Okay. So to both of you, This outage has been frustrating. I received an email this morning from someone who said, "Yeah, I'm irritated. My power went off at about 3:30 this morning and the highest wind in air quotes there that I've seen all day is 6 miles per hour." So there's some agitation. Is that coming through in the questions you've been asked?
Absolutely, Emily, right? There have been numerous questions where people are upset, wondering why their area was shut down when it doesn't appear to have the power lines are underground and such. The problem is when PG&E pulls power on an area, sometimes they can choose to do it several different ways. They can do it at the circuit level, which can just be a block or they can do it on a much wider range. And PG&E has chosen to do the much wider range for much of this. They have done it at the circuit level in some areas, but so you might be part of one of those larger swath areas where your area really isn't getting much wind, but maybe just a mile or two down the road where it's more of a canyon situation, the winds are really whipping and you're part of the same general power switch.
Yeah, and I think especially with those website issues, people are really frustrated because they can't get information. So they're trying to plan, they're trying to figure things out. And when they Google PG&E power shutoff and click on the PG&E site, maybe they can't get to it. And we've gotten a lot of that on social media as we post information. Mm-hmm. We've heard from a lot of listeners who are just really upset because they're trying to plan their lives around this power outage and they haven't been able to do that, I think. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate the calm way that you two continue to deal with people as you either get the message online or talk to them. What else are our listeners asking, Randall?
Well, they've asked us directly, when is their power going to be turned back on, as though we have the switch.
Yeah.
But as we heard from OES right there, there are a lot of lines. Beth, you and I both looked at each other when he said that the amount of cable that needs to be inspected could wrap around the planet.
Right.
And I was, wow, yeah. I didn't realize it was that much. I knew it was a lot. So PG&E will go out and visually inspect. They have helicopters. They have the 6,000 people on the ground. There's no California law that says they have to do that. But I did speak with the CPUC yesterday, the Public Utilities Commission, who oversees PG&E, and they told me they are required to safely operate their equipment. And if that's how PG&E chooses to turn the power back on, then they're allowed to do that. And so that is how PG&E has chosen to do this. And you can see why that would make sense.
Emily, I know you're being asked about situations where there might be a medical need. And do those people have any option other than buying and installing a generator? Is there any other idea here?
Unfortunately, it seems like getting a generator is the simplest solution, but that is expensive. And then you have to get, you know, maybe gas to fuel the generator. And PG&E actually recommended that people who need electricity for medical needs, keeping medicine cool, using like a home oxygen machine, that they just need to plan ahead for these, which can be frustrating advice for people because they want a solution. They don't just want to be told, plan for this. So one solution is that PG&E does have resource centers open where you can go and maybe charge a portable medical device if you need to. And we have a list of those on the site as well. But for people who need a refrigerator, need to be able to plug in those medical machines, there's not a great solution outside of a generator.
And many of us don't have that level of disposable income that we could just jump out there and do that. And if you were listening to Morning Edition an hour ago, there was a heartbreaking story of a woman in the Sausalito area who had just gone to, I don't know, Costco or one of those big stores and purchased $450 worth of food that will now go bad.
You know, it's one reality to think about packing a bag in case of emergency or knowing where you'll meet outside of your house. It's another entirely to think about, where am I going to plug in my portable oxygen machine?
Yeah.
Where am I going to charge my phone in case I lose electricity? All right. So, Randall, let's talk about a question involving travel. What are you being asked?
Getting around. People were wondering if it would affect major roadways. For instance, the Caldecott Tunnel in the Bay Area is a major artery between the East, Far East Bay and the Oakland-Berkeley area. Caltrans rallied and kept the lights on there with generators. There was initially a plan to shut down the Caldecott, which would have been a really big deal, and it would have made the 80 corridor an absolute mess during the commute. But on a more localized level, when an intersection goes dark, that becomes a four-way stop. And Emily and I were somewhat laughing in the newsroom that the fact that we actually have to tell people how to do that, because it is one of the questions when you take the DMV test.
Remember to yield to the right,
right,
or whoever arrives first.
For people to remember that. So we do want to underscore that if you come up to a dark intersection, treat it as a four-way stop. The other thing people were wondering was about airports. And Sacramento County has not been impacted, so we're fine at the airport there. San Francisco International, or SFO, Oakland, and San Jose have all reported that they have backup generators should they be affected, and that it's business as usual at those airports.
Emily, Randall mentioned food spoiling in the refrigerator. Have there been other questions along that line?
Yeah, we had people asking us, would they be reimbursed for the food that they lost during this? And, you know, one of the things with the power outage is, you know, I grew up having power outages. And I remember my mom telling us, you know, don't open the refrigerator. We have to keep all the cold stuff in there still cold. But when you have the power out for a few days, you can lose all of the food in your fridge and refrigerator. And PG&E is not reimbursing for that with these outages. So they will not be giving the customers who are affected by this any money to remediate that lost food. And that's hard because, as Randall pointed out, not everyone can afford to just go and replace all of the food that they've been storing in their fridge. That can be a big expense.
And sometimes that includes medicines like insulin that needs to be kept cold.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're hearing Randall White and Emily Zentner from our CAP Radio News team. They're talking through answers to questions we've received from you about the public safety power outages. We're going to go through a few more questions, and then we will explain how you can ask anything else about the situation that we don't answer or that might apply to your situation. So, more questions, Randall. What are you being asked?
Well, a lot of people want to know, why doesn't PG&E just put the power lines underground, that would solve everything? And, you know, to some degree, it would. But when you've got enough lines to wrap around the planet,
the Earth,
it becomes a very expensive endeavor, more expensive than, you know, the costs of lives and property that we saw in Paradise and in the North Bay. People could argue over that, but PG&E says it is $3 million to convert 1 mile of overhead power lines into underground lines. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine just 1 mile and then multiply that by $3 million. Brandy Merlot, who I spoke to with PG&E, says that power lines are vulnerable to earthquakes and flooding and some other things that we might not think about.
If they're underground.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then when there is a problem with the line, finding where that problem is a lot more difficult because they're obscured by soil and rock and what have you. So, but they are considering it in some areas where it might make sense. Paradise, for instance, is one area that when they rebuild, they can put the power lines underground.
Okay, Emily, what else is everybody asking?
We kind of touched on this earlier. People were really confused if they were in an area that wasn't affected by high winds or an area where they do have those underground lines and they're still getting shut off. So I would say, you know, underscoring that, because we've gotten that a lot, it is dependent on how PG&E is shutting things down. And so sometimes you're just in that region and you get shut down with it. And we've gotten a lot of frustration from people over that, understandably.
Okay. We've been talking about PG&E and Southern California Edison as the utilities that are doing the shutdowns. I am guessing that people are calling saying, what about SMUD?
They are.
Am I going to be affected if I'm a SMUD customer?
I reached out to SMUD yesterday afternoon and was told that no, they're not planning any shutoffs. And they are not dependent on PG&E for their power. So if some of these lines might have been feeder lines that would come in for SMUD, it's not going to affect any of the SMUD customers. But I should say, in terms of Southern California Edison, I looked it up just before we came on, and up until just recently, there had been no customers affected. They have started shutting off power. There are three customers in Southern California that are affected. San Diego's power company at this moment has not initiated any power cutoffs.
All right. This is not the end of the questions. So for people who want to ask more, how do they reach you? How do they reach our newsroom?
They can go to capradio.org/insight, and if they click on the page for this segment, there's a little form at the bottom of the page, and they can send us their questions there, and Randall and I will see if we can answer them.
I think this has been so informative and so valuable. Thank you so much, and thank you, Randall, for checking everything right before we got here and for the communication with everybody. I think it's truly a public service, and I've been learning sitting here listening to you.
Well, we're happy to do it. I mean, and the our listeners, when they interact with us, you can tell that they're happy that we're taking their questions. So,
yeah.
All right. You can hear Randall this afternoon during ATC with updates to the current situation. You won't hear Emily, but she'll be sitting there tapping away. And on the computer, you'll see her on our digital presence. Emily Zentner, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you, Beth.
And we'll have continuing coverage of the outages and any wildfire situations that might come up at capradio.org. Up next, we're going to continue on this topic as Ben Adler joins me for this week's Capital Chat. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. So the power outages continue across the state. The governor and lawmakers are dealing with the intense reaction to that. And it's the end of the legislative session. So hundreds of bills are either being signed or vetoed. There's a lot to talk about in this week's Capital Chat. Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler is with me. Hi, Ben. And
hey.
How about how all this is playing for Governor Newsom?
Oh, it is of all the weeks for a governor to have to deal with. It's not technically, I guess, a state of emergency, but it's certainly one that the full force of the California's executive branch must be activated. This is probably not the first week that Newsom would have picked. He has until midnight Sunday to sign what began this week as probably, I think, 400 or 500 bills, now down to a little under 300. He's got a lot of work.
So every time he's in a public situation right now, he's not only asked about the legislation, but he's being asked about PG&E, the power outages. So for him, it's kind of coming in all directions.
Yes, for sure. And so he is holding these signing ceremonies throughout the state, and he's getting questions on the blackouts, even in San Diego yesterday, where, as you mentioned, you know, they do have an investor-owned utility. They are looking at a very limited number of blackouts. I had heard about 29,000 yesterday, customer accounts. So you roughly triple that. You get a little under 100,000 people down there who might be affected. But there were still questions down there. And of course, in Los Angeles, where Southern California Edison was considering 200,000 or so customer account blackouts. So roughly three times that would make it about 600,000. Not nearly as many as the well over 2 million potentially here with PG&E, yet still significant. And he really did have to face a walk a tightrope trying to balance both criticism for PG&E and, as we'll hear right now, acknowledging that he understands the reasons for these blackouts.
I don't think they're making a mistake as it relates to proactive measures to mitigate the prospect of fires. I think that's the right decision.
And yet, the obligatory criticism.
They're in bankruptcy because of their terrible management going back decades. They've created these conditions.
And I should be clear, he's referring specifically to PG&E, not to Southern California Edison or San Diego Gas and Electric. In fact, he compared PG&E very unfavorably to San Diego Gas and Electric because SDG&E is widely recognized as responding well to the massive fires in the San Diego area more than a decade ago and really instituting systems to help mitigate and prevent fires, which a lot of policymakers really want PG&E to do and think they should have already done.
I'm sure he's choosing words carefully to walk, as you say, that line between this being a public safety issue and then having the public utility in bankruptcy when there has been some admitted culpability. What are lawmakers, meanwhile, saying? Because sometimes they feel a lot freer to be more voracious with their descriptions and their opinions.
Well, sure. It's easy for one of 120 to be populist and represent your angry constituents. That's, in many ways, your job is to reflect their feelings and also advocate for them and agitate for them. But we're starting to see, I think, PG&E basically use up what little goodwill it may have left at the state capitol. It already wasn't able to get a bill that it wanted to help it exit bankruptcy through the legislature in the final weeks of session just because there was so much PG&E fatigue and anger after legislation over the summer that set up some taxpayer help, not necessarily as a bailout, but some taxpayer help to help PG&E and other utilities if there are some of these really big wildfires that maybe electric equipment was involved in, but it wasn't, you know, there wasn't specific negligence or liability. But I want to read you a little quote from State Senator Jim Nielsen, who represents Paradise. And he's a Republican, longtime lawmaker, not necessarily prone to bombastic rhetoric. But what he said is the legislature must rigorously examine whether PG&E is capable of responsibly delivering reliable, safe electricity to its rate-paying customers. I did follow up with his office and ask, well, hey, does this mean that he's looking at a breakup of PG&E? And I was told he's not there yet.
But what he is saying is don't look just at this immediate power shutoff. He's saying look at the big picture and the role that PG&E has overall in supplying power to the state.
And yet that while it does all of that, it was such a, I mean, I used a metaphor in a story I filed yesterday, a sledgehammer approach versus scalpel approach. Southern California Edison told me that they are making decisions on whether to shut down electricity in their coverage area circuit by circuit, not area or region, but circuit by circuit. Some circuits serve as few as 50 people. So if Southern California Edison is able to do that, and yet PG&E is just saying, okay, these whole big swaths are getting shut down, that shows a difference between the two utilities. Some sophistication, maybe better. You know, it's certainly true that PG&E has a much larger area affected than Southern California Edison. But you still look at those side by side. And, you know, so I got on the phone with a Stanford professor yesterday, Michael Wara, he's an expert in all of this. And I asked him a question that I think is on a lot of people's minds. PG&E is essentially saying, look, either we shut down power to 2 million plus people or we don't, and there's a significant risk of a wildfire. Isn't there anything in between, any sort of an alternative? Is PG&E setting up a false choice? And here's what Michael Wara of Stanford said.
I think it actually isn't a false choice. The weather forecast suggests very dangerous fire conditions, the kind that ignited the 2017 Napa and Sonoma wildfires over large parts of the state. And unfortunately, the utilities haven't had enough time to make the changes to their systems that they would need to in order to run them through that kind of a dangerous fire weather event and do it safely for their customers.
What all this is pointing us to is the decision that's going to be made in hindsight, looking at how the situation is handled now for how it might or will be handled next time. And I guess that's the next debate.
Yeah. And I mean, I also heard, you know, I got a listener email this morning who pointed out, look, I mean, PG&E is darned if it does, darned if it doesn't, right? It's going to get slammed if it does nothing and there's a big wildfire. In fact, it was considering one of these public safety power shutoffs in the Paradise area last year, on the very morning that the campfire began.
Right.
They did not act. This fire began. We know what happened. Now it's seeing very challenging weather conditions, and it's saying, well, we really want to make sure that that doesn't happen again. So we're going to shut off power for days to more than 2 million Californians. So, I mean, you might wonder, is there something in between? And what Michael Wara is saying is, at least right now, and he went on in an interview that we ran on Morning Edition that we'll put up online if you missed it at capradio.org. He went on to say, look, I mean, you know, they do need to get better at their systems. There ought to be eventually a better way of doing this, something more targeted, but they're not there yet. They are playing catch up to utilities like San Diego Gas and Electric.
You are listening to Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler, and we have called this a balancing act week for the governor. He also has these hundreds of bills to sign or veto. He's not a long-term experienced governor, so this is a new process for him. There's a pending deadline. Let's talk about a big school bond measure that he has signed and the context of it.
So you, if you live in California and are a registered voter, are going to vote on a $15 billion with a B, $15 billion school bond on the March 2020 ballot. Here's your PSA of the week. The primary is in March this year. It's not in June. That's when you vote for Democratic presidential primary, or if you're Republican, vote for President Trump. And there will be at least one ballot measure, and it is this $15 billion school bond. It is for modernization and construction of facilities at schools of all age levels, starting with preschool, running through K-12, through community colleges, all the way up to the UC and CSU system. What is noteworthy for Newsom signing this is it is a break from his predecessor. Former Governor Jerry Brown really tried to limit bonds placed on the ballot. He blocked for a couple of years a school bond until in 2016 outside groups, both school groups and construction groups, which would benefit from this, said, you know, we're done with this. They gathered signatures, put it on the ballot. Jerry Brown scorned it as a blunderbuss effort and voters approved it anyway. Brown did manage to limit the size of bonds on housing and on parks and water ahead of last year. That was 2018. And they both passed, but he did manage to keep the sizes down. He's out of office, and all of a sudden you've got another school bond. This is, you know, 3 years since the 2016 bond passed. Backers say that money's already gone. There is a big need. And so they got together and everyone wrote a $15 billion school bond. So that is, I think, just worth highlighting, not just because it's a ballot measure, but it's a big change in policy. And Brown even warned in an interview that ran on Insight here a couple of weeks ago, look, bond and pension debt need to be paid come hell or high water. And so if and when there's a recession, the bonds sound good in theory financially right now. $15 billion for school facilities, and a lot of it's really needed. But the money's going to have to get paid, and it's going to run into other costs that the state has during the recession, other programs that might need to be cut.
Because this is a ballot measure, we will get much more into the details of what was signed between now and March. I do want to hit one other, which was the rent cap. You just mentioned housing and homelessness. So rent cap is a measure that's aimed at dealing with the state's crisis.
Capping rent increases at 5% plus inflation, protecting tenants from evictions without just cause, and blocking landlords from raising rents right before the cap takes effect. So, that was the product of negotiations between the governor, Democratic legislative leaders, and tenant, landlord, and business groups. And as Newsom signed the bill on Tuesday in Oakland, he couldn't help but take a jab at his favorite target, President Trump, referring to the president being in California recently and criticizing California's housing and homelessness crises.
We had a president of the United States come in here just a few days ago, like a seagull that comes in and does what seagulls do and fly away. If you haven't figured that out, just think about that for a second. But he wasn't wrong to highlight the issue, wasn't wrong to highlight a vulnerability. He's exploiting it. You're trying to solve it.
So the seagull joke there shows that we've had a wide range of not only responsibilities, but colors in this week in the descriptions. So.
Yes. And sure to continue both with PG&E and bills all the way up to, at least for the bills.
The deadline is
midnight Sunday. I can tell you how much I'm looking forward to working Sunday night.
And he hasn't vetoed a lot to this point.
About 5%.
Okay.
But in fairness, let's wait to evaluate his entire body of work. He still has 300 bills left. And a lot of times with Jerry Brown, too, the veto pace would pick up in the final batches.
All right. Thank you, Ben.
You're welcome.
That's Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler. You can find more state government news and, of course, continuing coverage of the power outages and topics related at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Meadowview in 2018 became another place in the United States where a police shooting of an unarmed black man ignited controversy, outcry, and protest. The death of Stephon Clark in March of that year highlighted some historic problems: poverty, racism, policing issues, a lack of investment by the city, a lack of trust between people. So it might have been easy to miss everything else that Meadowview is and has been: a beloved home to generations of families, a springboard for bright personalities and successful careers, and a place of beauty and rich culture. And those are the stories that CAP Radio's documentary unit, The View From Here, went looking for. And their podcast, Making Meadowview, premieres today. Reporter and host Pauline Bartolone spent a year exploring the work and the people of Meadowview. She's joining me in the studio. Hi, Pauline.
Hi, thanks for having us.
This is a big beginning day today for the project.
Yeah.
Coach Robert Roots Sr. is here. He was born and raised in Meadowview, and he's the basketball coach at John Still K-8 School. Hi, Coach.
Hi, thank you for having
you
me.
You probably have a lot of students and former students listening to
Oh,
you.
Yes, we do.
And Sac State Geography professor Dr. Robin Daddle researches the history of neighborhoods. She can take us back to the shape of this area when Meadowview began. Hi, Professor. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
So with that story, can you take us back in time and tell me the atmosphere when Meadowview began to be a neighborhood?
So initially, Meadowview was, of course, part of a Native American geography, and then after that, really a rural area, mostly Anglo settlers, but pretty early on some people of color. And then it gets built up as a suburban neighborhood after the Second World War. So it's part of a big wave, a big growth that happened to Sacramento, tremendous growth. Really in the starting in the late 50s and then through the 60s and 70s. And it's part of a much larger wave of that on multiple different sides of Sacramento.
And Coach Roots, that time, the 60s into the 70s, is when you were young and growing up. How do you remember Meadowview as a child?
When we were younger, it was a rural area. I mean, it was, you know, they had open air markets and stuff. You know, they didn't have a lot of, you know, violence or nothing like that. It was pretty quiet.
When did it change significantly? When did you notice that?
Probably in the 80s. In the 80s, it was pretty tough. It got pretty bad out there.
You had gone away and came back.
Yes. I went away in the military, and it was all bad out there. And I came back, and it was like, it was 100%, you know, it just changed. Everything changed. You know, stores out, you know, people out, stuff you wouldn't see. You never thought you would see out there. You know, it was totally different.
What did you think had happened?
I wasn't sure. I thought they were going to change the area like they do all the other ones. You know, it's usually a bad area, and they, you know, put everybody to another area and make it good. And that's what they do in most of the other neighborhoods, and this one didn't. You know, the same people were there, and they started changing everything with the same people. So that worked out pretty good, you know.
Professor Daddle, you do some work on neighborhoods that get a rough reputation. And then they change, or they try to change, but it's really tough to emerge from a rough reputation. How would you apply that to Meadowview?
Well, I think, as Coach was saying, there were pretty tough times in Meadowview in the 1980s and early 1990s. And it did get a reputation outside the neighborhood as being violent. It was certainly associated with drugs and with gangs and with drive-by shootings. And again, even though that's a minority of people in the neighborhood who engage in that activity, that label comes to be applied to the neighborhood as a whole. I mean, there's a long history of racializing crime, so African Americans in particular bear that particular burden, and it has staying power. So even as things got better, and maybe we could kind of date that to when the community center got built in 1995, and gradually have improved since then, that old image that people have does persist and does affect their willingness to go there, to invest there, to patronize businesses there. And so what you're doing with this series is fighting back against that, which personally I think is really wonderful.
Pauline, I want to get to you in a second, but Coach Roots, with what the professor just said, that community center, that's the area you came back to, right?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yes, we lived right across the street from the community center. It wasn't there when I left.
And you had some expectations about what would be around something like a community center.
Yeah, I mean, we thought it would be different, but when they built that community center, it changed. It gave kids places to go, something to do. You know, before they didn't have anywhere to go, you know, nothing to do.
So, Pauline, we're going to introduce the podcast, but to do that, you also wrote a feature for Sacramento News and Review, which is out today. And the term ghetto view is mentioned in the article, which ties in exactly with what Professor Daddle is describing. Did Meadowview residents talk about enduring this label and the perspective that they haven't been able to shake?
Yeah, they did. And just to clarify about that term ghetto view, we did kind of camp out outside the Golden One Center before King's game, and we just asked people what their perception was of Meadowview, what they knew about it. Most people didn't know that much, but a couple of people said, oh, you mean ghetto view, or that's where there's high crime. And this was in the aftermath of the Stephon Clark shooting. Mm. But yeah, in terms of when we talked to people in Meadowview, people were frustrated about this perception that it's ghetto or high crime rates. And what we found in the reporting is that it actually has relatively low crime rates. If you look at it by city council district, Meadowview's area, which includes a parkway and Valley High, has the second lowest crime rate, overall crime rate, in Sacramento. And that might be surprising to people.
Well, District 8 City Councilman Larry Carr is quick to point that out over and over. And I think he's had to point it out over and over for some people to believe it.
Yeah, it's definitely a sore point for him. But the people we talked to said, you know, when I moved to Meadowview, it was like a step up. You know, in the 80s, before the crack cocaine epidemic, they were just saying, you know, this was, people were lucky if they got a house in Meadowview. And they think of it now as a safe, affordable place to live. You can buy a home at affordable rates, and they're happy.
So we've talked around the podcast. Before we get into it more, let's listen. And you're going to hear a few minutes from the beginning of episode one, which is online at capradio.org, or it's wherever you get your podcasts. But here is the start of the new Cap Radio project, Making Meadowview.
If you've spent any time in Meadowview, a semi-suburban neighborhood 8 miles south of downtown Sacramento, you'll know it's like taking a trip around the world.
Viva, viva!
Elderly Spanish speakers meet every Friday at a community center to dance and socialize. Families of Hmong refugees attend public school in their ancestors' native language.
Good morning, parents, guardians.
Hundreds of Pacific Islanders go to church services on Sunday.
Brothers and sisters, malolele.
But if you've heard anything about this neighborhood lately, it's most likely about this. The uproar after Stephon Clark was killed by police in 2018. But that event doesn't really say much at all about what this neighborhood is about. So we decided to listen more closely to people in Meadowview and bring you stories about leaders of the many ethnic communities here who are making life the best it can be. They're working for the next generation. This neighborhood is full of young people.
I'm always excited when I can help honor young people because I want them to know we need them to be okay, you know?
Capital Public Radio spent a year in Meadowview, and we found, in many ways, it's like all our neighborhoods. Just take it from LeVar Burton, star of Reading Rainbow and Star Trek. You remember the 70s miniseries Roots? He lived here as a teenager.
Meadowview is a microcosm for the United States of America. Our story is your story. People here strive, they love, they live, they laugh, they cry. Meadowview is a real place with real people, with real dreams and aspirations.
So in this podcast, you'll hear about people struggling to realize their dreams, like we all are. But the difference is, in Meadowview, the challenges are a little steeper. Like, there are gangs in my neighborhood. My employer's racist. Or, I don't have a bed to sleep on. We'll bring you 6 stories of how people are tackling problems in Meadowview that seem insurmountable. But we'll also hear about a lot of successes and what's working for people here. I'm Pauline Bartolone. I'm your guide in this series, Making Meadowview, from Capital Public Radio's The View From Here.
Making Meadowview has launched today. You can find it online. I'm talking with host and producer Pauline Bartolone. And of course, there's been the View From Here team working on this project. Will you say something more about other people that are profiled in the episodes?
Yeah, so there are going to be 7 episodes, and basically it's a series of stories about protagonists in this neighborhood, people struggling to improve the situation for the next generation. We hear from a football coach who's trying to help people realize their dreams of becoming professional athletes. We hear from a group of Polynesians who are kind of steering young people away from crime by learning traditional dance. We profile a woman who's quite obsessed with 311. So whenever there's a neighborhood eyesore, she's the one who calls the city. And we profile Mai Vang, who's actually the school board member representing Meadowview. And she's really been a champion for public schools in the area. So these are in-depth stories. We follow people over time. It's not just a long news story. It's a pretty intimate storytelling.
Dr. Daddle, different sources of information about a community can do much to add or take away from the impression of it. And beyond this kind of a project, all of what was said and done during the time of Stephon Clark even varied. And I bring that up to talk about the Sacramento Observer. The publisher, Larry Lee, was here yesterday. It is an African-American newspaper. Can you address some of the differences in how a situation might be reported in that type of media versus a longer distance mainstream media?
Sure. The Sacramento Observer has been absolutely critical in presenting a more positive view of African American neighborhoods, Oak Park, Del Paso Heights, Meadowview, than the mainstream media projects. And they know those places and the people in them more intimately. And it's really important to balance the view of the predominantly white mainstream media with those insights. And there are all kinds of other sources of information, and I would encourage people as a geographer to go to Meadowview and check it out. Patronize the businesses, talk to people, go to church there. Read church bulletins, look at church websites, look at the school's websites. There are so many additional sources of information now that we can get, and it really will help transform your view of a neighborhood that has this lingering negative image.
That is Sac State Geography Professor Dr. Robin Daddle. She teaches courses on urban geography, economic geography, the Sacramento region, and Europe. And her research focuses on the social, cultural, and economic patterns and landscapes of the greater Sacramento area. Meadowview is part of the city of Sacramento. I have with me Coach Robert Roots, Sr. He is a basketball coach at John Still Elementary, born and raised in Meadowview. And tell me about young people. The young kids that you're surrounded by now, what's their vision of life around them, and what? How do they look at the future?
There's so many different cultures out there now. Before, there was not that many. Now, there's various. I mean, there's a lot of them. And the majority of them want to, you know, they want to get on with their life and be positive with stuff. But there's still some out there that's probably from that, you know, day and age where their parents were out there when it was bad, and they still got the little attitude and get tough. But, you know, they're coming around. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on for them now that they could get used to having something to look forward to.
What do you think the impact has been and will be on them because of the Stephon Clark era and the youngness of their lives?
Well, some of them still look at it as harassment, or the police, you know, out to get them. And it's like, you know, we tell them it's not all that. You know, you have to get out there and do something with your life. You have to get out there and interact with them. You know, don't just see them as the police coming out doing this and doing that. Go out and talk to them. Say hi to them. You know, the police have to do the same thing. You have to get out and interact with the community instead of just driving by in your car and looking, because the kids still get the same attitude, you know, when they see that. So they need to interact more with them.
Pauline, it's important to say that this isn't typical reporting, that you really are much more intimate and in-depth in the stories of the people you're going to profile.
That's right. And I'm personally really proud that we're doing a podcast about Sacramento. A lot of people who like to listen to podcasts, who are CAP Radio listeners, they're probably always listening to a story but somewhere else. Or it's, you know, a global issue, or it's a lot of experts talking. But this is really a series of stories about people in our community. You know, every community has a football coach. Every community has someone who calls 311 to report grass that's too high.
I'm sometimes that person.
Yeah. And these are just the local stories of people in our neighborhood who are solving problems. You know, some people ask, why should I care about Meadowview if I don't live in Meadowview? And the answer is that people in Meadowview are like everywhere else, you know, people struggling to realize their dreams and tackling big problems. And there's a lot of wisdom in Meadowview, and that's what we could all benefit from by listening to the podcast.
Pauline, thank you. Your team, Jen Picard, Andrew Nixon, Paul Conley, Jessica Maria Ross, a number of other people.
So many people worked on this project.
So again, it launches today. You can find Making Meadowview at capradio.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone.
And maybe one final word from both Dr. Daddle and Coach Roots about what you want for Meadowview. One final word as you look at its future. Coach Roots?
Growth.
A good one.
That is a good one. And Dr. Daddle?
Everybody wants to feel safe in their neighborhood, and to have especially young people feel safe and like it's a place they want to be and they feel loved and supported.
That is Sac State Professor Dr. Robin Daddle. Thank you so much for joining us. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruiak. Insight is produced by Helen Barrington, Kate Gonzalez, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagan and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today, Anthony Van Hook. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian, and our executive producer is Joe Barr. We've covered a lot of issues, a lot of information, and you can find even much more at capradio.org/insight. I'm Beth Ruiak. Thanks for joining us.